everybody, and welcome back to another episode of Vegan Proteins Muscles by Brussels Radio. My name is Danny.
And I'm Giacomo.
And this is our 71st episode. Hey everybody, welcome back. Thanks so much for tuning into another episode. We are here in the middle of our first nor'easter as we record this today. We've got like, 14, 16 inches outside and it's still going and it's windy as heck and we're hunkering down and recording a podcast.
I honestly didn't even realize that a storm was coming.
Me either.
And in typical me fashion, I by the seat of my pants, as I usually fly by on things, somebody was like, hey, there's a storm coming tomorrow. We're getting ready for it. And I'm like, oh, crap. And I just like got the snowblower ready and made sure there was enough gas for it. I just started like running around like, that's what we do out here in New England. When a foot comes, it takes like several hours just to make sure to clear the snow and make sure your house is accessible.
It depends on where you live. But I actually think it's really silly how much people run around to prepare for a foot of snow like we don't see it 27 times every single year. My favorite is the way people drive the first time it snows for the year. It's like, I'm sorry, did you not grow up in this? Did you forget what it's like to drive in the snow?
I feel like you're setting me up right now, hook, line, and sinker, for when we lived in Portland, Oregon, and they had like their first snowstorm ever, like in 50 years, and they didn't know what to do. I saw people shoveling snow with paint trays. Like literally trying to clear a foot of snow out of their driveway with paint trays, driving on streets with chains on their tires.
First of all, it wasn't even a foot of snow. It was like 6 inches of snow, and Giacomo and I had just moved there from the Northeast, him from New York and me from Massachusetts. And we were like laughing at people because of how lost they were. People, they were like shoveling their driveway with the tops of the tops of garbage pails. And we were like, what are people doing? And then of course we looked at each other and we're like, shit, we don't have a shovel either. Like, how are we gonna do this? But the chains is an interesting thing because people hear the word snow in the Northwest and everybody chains up their tires, which was something that I had never even heard of growing up in New England where we see a ton of snow.
Well, I feel like it's one of those weird phenomenas, like living next to a mountain where eventually it's mandatory to wear chains, but then that makes sense. But
this was like a flat city.
Exactly. Or like when you're on like a super steep incline and you're, I don't know, way up a mountain and maybe then you need to put on your emergency brake, but not when you're on a flat. And so people would do weird things like that in the Pacific Northwest. And I'm like, I guess I understand where it's coming from, but it also did not make sense in practice.
Yeah, I mean, in actuality, the more we watch this snowstorm unfold in the Pacific Northwest, the whole city of Portland, which I think has like 500,000 people, or at least it did 10 years ago, the whole city had like 12 plows. The tiny town that we live in now, probably, I mean, everybody that owns a truck also owns a plow, because as soon as it snows, you can throw that plow on the front of your truck and go make like $25 an hour to just plow the city. So we have hundreds of plows going around. So it is different, but it's just, it was funny at the time.
Funny to look back on. And in the meanwhile, our driveway is cleared so we can receive pallets and pallets more of goodies for you for the Vegan Strong boxes, which we just keep pumping out. We got, this weekend we did,
300. We made 300 December Vegan Strong boxes, which they're sick, guys. Like we can't tell you what's in them because it's a surprise, but it's very holiday themed. And I suppose if you order it the day that this podcast comes out, you will not get it by Christmas, but it's still like, it's a good gift. And I think they're very cool.
Oh yeah, for sure.
What's happening this weekend, Giacomo? Something is coming up this coming weekend. What is it?
Listen, we had a sit down and we were like, are we going to talk about this or are we going to do this episode? And I said, we're going to do this episode. I made an agreement that we're not going to talk about this.
Giacomo has a birthday coming up. Technically, it's on Monday, but we're going to celebrate it together on Sunday. How old are you turning?
It's my 19th, 21st birthday, and I don't do math very well, so.
Giacomo is turning the big 4-0. I don't know why you're like embarrassed by this, because anytime I tell somebody, yeah, Giacomo's almost 40, their jaw like hits the floor because nobody... Nobody guesses that you're even close to 40. In fact, most people think that Giacomo is probably younger than I am, which I suppose I should be insulted by, because Giacomo's almost 6 years older than me.
Yeah, I really don't know how to take that. I swear I behave like a 40-year-old, and I think I'm starting to feel my age as far as looking like a 40-year-old. Yeah, so that's kind of sad, but that's reality, I suppose.
I disagree. Not that there's anything wrong with 40-year-olds. You know, as I get older, I realize 40-year-olds can be pretty handsome. That's all I'm saying.
I don't know. I don't know. You remind me that I have dead old middle-aged man smell at times, and I'm like starting to like smell myself, and I'm like, you know what? She's probably right. I'm dying.
We were reading yesterday things kids write about what they imagine life will be like when they're XYZ years old. That was one of the things some 8-year-old girl wrote. I am 40. I have quit my job because I am having trouble walking. I will die soon. I know I will die soon. Oh, God.
Which is like the perfect segue into what this episode is all about. Self-care. And it's not what you think it is. Because the older you get, the more important it is to take care of yourself. But not in the ways that the media portrays self-care, which is like, oh, just drop some essential oil in the bath and relax. Or like, listen to the top 20 for the next 20 days and just like feel good. Yay, good feels on the surface.
So is there, like, Giacomo, does top 20 even exist anymore?
I just said that.
Did you just age yourself with that one sentence?
I think I did.
No, he's right. I feel like over the last like 10 years or so, I feel like self-care has become, or this idea of self-care has become really chic, really trendy, really in vogue. And it's like, you know, we even have what so many people say, treat yourself, where it's like anytime you want to do something or get something for yourself or eat something for yourself, you just have that treat yourself mentality and it's okay because that's self-care. The more I think about it, the more I realize like a lot of times that is not self-care. So, I mean, sometimes it's even like self-harm. Sometimes it's self-care. I think that absolutely sometimes like taking a bubble bath and like watching some back-to-back movies totally can be self-care. But that is like literally the tip of the iceberg of what self-care is. And really, I think that's more like consumer self-care. Like that is self-care being marketed to you in a specific way so that you buy more face masks and bubble baths and nail polish. That to me is not really self-care at all.
Right.
It's like the equivalent of putting perfume on and not taking a shower.
Basically. And we don't want to guilt or shame people for indulging and enjoying and feeling good and taking care of your personal hygiene or like doing a little something extra in that department. If that's the only thing that you're focused on and you think you're taking care of yourself and the real work isn't getting done, you're going to turn around and look at your life and realize that you're unhappy, or like not admit to yourself that you're unhappy and wonder why, or be in a state of anxiety that you can't understand. If you don't take care of yourself emotionally, not just physically, because I feel like most people that listen to this podcast are already ascribed to the notion of, yes, take care of yourself physically. I'm talking emotionally, I'm talking spiritually, and I'm talking about like really evaluating your life and yourself, like doing that deep, painful work that doesn't feel good. It doesn't give you any sort of instant gratification.
Yeah, self-care is a lot of times it's almost like sold to you as this quick fix to feel better, which again, like it can be, you can do those things. I do those things. I love me a good bubble bath. That does make me feel good instantly. But real, like true, deep self-care, actually, it can feel really bad while you're doing it, but that doesn't make it any less important. You know, think about what it's like when you're working out. When you are actually in the middle of a hard workout, it doesn't feel good. It hurts. Every single rep, you're like, oh God, do I have to do another rep? Yeah, come on, just a couple more, just a couple. I love working out, and that's still true even for me. I'm not like, oh man, this hurts, I love it. I'm like, oh man, this hurts, please God, make it stop. But then when it's over, I feel much better. And I know that I did something really good for myself, right?
Right.
Self-care is the same way, or it should be the same way. It's less about treating yourself and more about parenting yourself or taking care of yourself in very adult ways.
And that's a hard pill to swallow because parenting oneself can almost feel, oh, I don't know, like a waste of time or something that is just not worth your focus or your energy. But the truth is that if you don't do it, you get to a point in your life where it's like, who will? And things worsen around you because you didn't take that time to take care of your financial health, or you didn't take your time to do some soul searching and understand why you are who you are, right? Feelings and emotions, you can ignore them, but they don't go away. And if you don't govern them and you don't become aware of who you are and why you are the way that you are, someone else is going to basically be living your life for you because they can see it before you can. So it's like, it's hard to get past the ego and to do some self-reflection, but that kind of work is very, very important. And like Danny said, it's painful. And I think that's why people shy away from it. Let's get real here. Taking a nice warm bath feels really, really good. And it's a great way to tune out the world. And that stuff is like, yeah, enjoy the hell out of it unapologetically. Do that and also do that real kind of work. And I think that's one of my, we'll say, mantras for the past year and a half. I'll find some success in something and I'm like, now the real work begins. It's that long-term wellness, not just those wellness checks, that create an environment for you that no one and nothing can take away. It makes it so that you can find a solution to any problem as opposed to running away from problems as if they're not there.
And Giacomo's talking about like deep emotional self-care, but sometimes it doesn't even have to be that deep. Some of the things people think about immediately as self-care, especially if you listen to this podcast, right? Probably the things we just said, because everybody thinks of a spa day as self-care, but also things like sleeping well, exercising, eating healthy, balanced meals. If you're listening to this podcast, you're probably like, yeah, duh, right? Of course, that's self-care. But there are other things too, like dealing with your finances, actually looking at your finances and making sure that they're in order and that you're like trying to set yourself up for the future as best as you can. That's self-care. Making sure that you go to all of your scheduled preventative doctor's appointments. That's self-care. Setting boundaries with coworkers or friends or family or even your partner, just setting up healthy boundaries for yourself. That is self-care. These things, it's not even that like, oh, it's so hard and it's so painful. It's almost that it feels like it's just annoying. It feels like a chore. Going and taking that bubble bath to, as you just said, like tune out the world. Yes, that can be self-care. But if you're doing it as a way to avoid those other things that I just said, is it self-care or is it actually just like self-harm and procrastination?
For sure. Yeah. There's other things you could do too. Something as simple as committing to yourself to take a couple of deep breaths once or twice a day, getting up and out of the house and going for like, I don't know, a 10, 15 minute walk just to get out of your head, or something as simple as journaling for 5 minutes twice a week. Any one of those things can really help you get out of your hamster wheel. I like to use that term a lot because I feel like we can go around and around in a circle, and before you know it, we're not making smarter choices because we're circumstances of our own environment that we have not tried to improve.
Other things that I consider to be self-care are not necessarily things that you do, but things that you don't do. There are things that a lot of us do, and you, Giacomo and I, are totally guilty of a lot of these things ourselves, that like we can convince ourselves that it's self-care and that it's good for us, but if you really step back and evaluate it, it's not. You know, we just said exercise is good for you. Well, pushing yourself to the freaking wall every single time you set foot into the gym, like pushing past your limits, that's not good for you. That's actually harmful for you, and it's not going to help, certainly not going to help your physique goals, that's for sure, but it's not going to help anything going on in your body. Like pushing the appropriate amount is self-care. Killing yourself, not self-care. Working really hard for your future is self-care. Overextending yourself at work for the sake of impressing other people, not self-care. Making time with friends that you value, that are important to you, that you care about, great. Going out with people just for the sake of it, to like keep up with the social circles, even though it doesn't really mean anything to you, not self-care. I think it's not just evaluating the things that you need to do, but also looking at the things that you are doing and seeing, is this actually helpful or is this actually harmful? And it's a really hard thing to ask, and you really, really need to do a lot of self-reflection on it. The media would just love it if all you thought self-care was like eating bonbons and painting your nails and watching Netflix. And it's like, it's actually laughable when you understand the brevity of what really taking care of yourself looks like.
Self-care is really hard to sell because it means doing the thing in the moment that isn't exciting and is usually painful.
Or boring.
Or boring, exactly. To lead to a better outcome in the future. That's really hard to sell to somebody. I kind of feel like we go through that a lot when we are starting an interview with a potential client, and it's like they're looking at me and we're going through the call and they want me to get them excited about something or like sell them on like the next best thing. And I find that there's a lot of that in the fitness industry.
Totally.
And this is not me judging individuals. This is me judging the industry on a whole without singling out anyone or any type of service. I feel like the fitness industry makes it so that you are basically coerced into selling someone a quick fix or selling someone a total body transformation and then marketing that total body transformation however you can. And I mean, I feel like we've fought that kind of mindset for a very long time. I'm not like talking ourselves up. It's a matter of how I feel like I want to be seen as a coach. I don't want to be seen as that person that's going to get you excited and say like, I'm going to get you to where you want to be no matter what in the next 12 weeks, because that's going to make you a better person. Like, you might get there, but at what cost? And can you maintain it? And was it worth your mental health?
Right. Like, right. Is that self-care? Like, to the context of this podcast, is just beating the crap out of yourself with a crazy deficit and a ton of cardio as a means of seeing a certain number on the scale, is that self-care? I can totally see how someone would get into it thinking that it is, but in hindsight, they are going to realize that it wasn't and that it was probably a lot closer to self-harm.
Right. So from like a perspective as a coach, it makes me think like, oh, you know, am I being seen as someone who's wussing out or is not going to go hard with my client? And it couldn't be further from the truth. I think we need to prove to ourselves that we can take it there responsibly before we do it. You know, by no stretch of the imagination are we the types of coaches that are not going to push our clients. We're just going to push our clients when they're ready to be pushed, and it's going to be something that is consensual, essentially.
Or in the areas that they need to be pushed. The area that somebody needs to be pushed to reach their fitness or physique goal, sometimes it has little to do with diet and it has little to do with their fitness. Sometimes it's like, girl, you are burning the candle at every single end. How are you expecting to reach this goal? You need to reassess some of the stressors in your life. Or sometimes it's people just kind of like ignoring much bigger health problems that are underlying, that it's like, okay, so you're doing everything else right and it's not working, this other thing is going on, and you're gonna need to get to the bottom of that before we actually are able to take some more steps forward. I totally hear what you're saying. Yes, the fitness industry does encourage anybody who's in this to sell something glamorous, make it glamorous, make this thing as sexy as possible, and people are gonna pay for it, even if that's a lie. And most of the time it is a lie, or it's temporary or whatever, but that doesn't mean that it's not hard. It doesn't matter that the more bland, I guess, the less exciting things that we're talking about here, like that is where the real magic happens, period. End of story. Like that's where the magic happens, and you get to keep the results that you get from that. So where I see in our industry this treat yourself mentality more than anything else is with food. Absolutely, with food. I think that some of, you know, what we talk about a lot is flexible dieting. I think that flexible dieting actually can almost exacerbate this. So people who ascribe to a more clean eating lifestyle, they've already convinced themselves that cookies are bad, donuts are bad. You know, if you look at a salt shaker, it's gonna make you fat, which of course isn't true. There's zero truth to that whatsoever. But when you talk about flexible dieting, basically what we're talking about is being able to incorporate a little bit more fun food into your life while still reaching your goals. But that can also make people think that they can and should, quote unquote, treat themselves to, you know, less nutritionally dense food more frequently because they can make it work. They should make it work.
I think I see where you're going with this. There's that fear that if you're not the type that is more of a clean eater, that you'll basically create excuses for yourself and flexibly fit in
more junk than you should.
Right. Hyper palatable, calorically dense comfort food.
Yes. And believe it or not, I actually think that is the lesser of the two evils. Because at least when people do ascribe to a flexible dieting mentality, at least they are making it fit within their constructs, even if they're eating more less nutritionally dense food than I would like. Hey, it is still going to work. You are still going to get the results. When somebody does ascribe to like a clean eating mindset or a meal plan mindset or an all or nothing mindset, and then they want a cookie, they say, oh, well, you know, just treat yourself. Have the cookie. It's not one cookie. It's 10 cookies. They have all the cookies and they've convinced themselves that it's somehow self-care. This can cause so much damage, definitely to your goals. Like it can undo all of the progress that you made. You can undo 2 weeks worth of progress in one day with one of these episodes. Absolutely. But more than that, the mentality of it, it's like part of you is trying to convince yourself that this was self-care and that it was okay. And it's like, man, my body really wanted that. But then the other part of you mentally is just beating yourself up so badly and feeling like, well, I just need to be 10 times as strict tomorrow and then this just won't happen again. We just have to be really, really, really deliberate. Deliberate. That's the word I'm looking for. Intentional about the way that we decide to indulge in more treat-like foods. It shouldn't just be mindless snacking in front of the TV for the sake of quote unquote treating yourself, because that's not really treating yourself. Treating yourself is like, you know, we've talked about this with the holidays, having your grandma's apple pie that she made special for you and having a piece of it, like totally guilt-free because you know you probably won't see that again till next year, assuming grandma is still around next year. Like to me, that is treating yourself. And of course, it's a totally case-by-case basis. And sometimes having a little serving of ice cream at the end of the day in front of the TV, sometimes that is self-care. But how intentional are you being? How often are you doing these things? And are you doing it to avoid the other things that you should be doing? To me, that's very, very important because I can go paint my nails and do an oil treatment in my hair and eat chocolate and watch my favorite show and avoid much, much, much more important things. It's like slapping a coat of paint on a house that's falling down. It doesn't make any sense.
I like that you went off on that really to drive that point home because it's very true. The case-by-case basis thing is what I want to expand on because I feel like saying this can almost sometimes lead to promoting it. And I don't know that it's necessary for everyone. I just know, or at least I feel like the belief needs to be there. The philosophy around how you eat, not necessarily the behavior. So yeah, these are options that are not off the table. Like having that holiday treat or enjoying yourself at the end of the day. It creates a safer place for you to have these decisions be on the table. And when you do exercise the option to make these decisions, sometimes it's conscious, intentional, sometimes it's not. That's okay. We're not perfect beings. It's okay to be human. It just makes it so that after the fact, because you have this philosophy that it is possible to make these choices guilt-free and without the food fear, that it is also possible to still eat healthfully.
Essentially, when I think of self-care on the whole, I'm thinking about intentionally trying to build a life that I don't need to constantly retreat from. I don't need to constantly escape from, because isn't that the goal? Shouldn't the goal to actually be to just have a life that, you know, it doesn't have to be perfect. Who the hell's life is perfect? Who the hell loves every second of their life? Nobody. But if your life is so exhausting and depleting all the time that you feel the need to retreat into these little trivial self, quote unquote, self-care type of activities all the time, that's the problem. The problem, you know, these little things, they're not going to fix the problem. They're just going to give you an escape from the problem, which is okay sometimes, but the problem is still there. Systemically, your life is too exhausting and too hard and too depleting, and it's not set up in a way that is making you feel good. It might be set up in a way that's making you look good. From the outside, it can look like you have everything together and that's wonderful, but that is part of the parenting of yourself and self-care. You're not trying to build a life that looks good. You're trying to build a life that actually feels good to you. And sometimes this also means like letting go of some of the areas that you feel this need to like chase perfection in.
Such as?
Oh boy. Such as trying to have the biggest, nicest house on the block or having the cleanest kitchen in your zip code. Like, does that actually matter to you? Maybe it does. Having six-pack abs year-round, does that actually matter to you? Or are you just doing it to try to impress other people and it's actually making your life kind of suck more? If that's the case, nobody needs to have six-pack abs year-round. Like, I don't. Giacomo doesn't. Giacomo almost does, though. He's a jerk.
you don't know. Don't make me go there.
But, you know, I do know a lot of people who are like killing themselves all the time to achieve and maintain six-pack abs year-round. And is this making you happier? Is this adding value to your life in some way? I'm all for every single human being alive getting in lots of healthy, balanced foods and achieving fitness and building muscle and getting stronger and feeling good. But as we've talked about on a zillion podcasts before, you can get to a place where you're chasing that fitness goal so hard and so extensively that it is costing you happiness in your life. You can take it too far. That's literally what bodybuilders do when we get ready for competitions. We deliberately take it too far. We say, hey, my life, my happiness, my sex drive, my sleep, it's about to be in the shitter for the next 3 months. And that's the trade-off I'm willing to make to look this way on stage for 5 minutes. Is that crazy? A little bit, but hey, we love it. And that's a deliberate choice. But a lot of times when people are not getting ready for a competition or they're not even competitors at all, they're still chasing this bodybuilder, physique, competitor, fitness model, physique, that what they don't understand is that even those people are not maintaining it year round because it's not worth the costs that you have to pay for with your happiness in your life. That's why bodybuilders have seasons.
Especially in the natural arena where afterwards it's crucial to take care of yourself. Like absolutely crucial to repair and rebuild all the areas of your life that weren't competition prep, which eventually becomes its own entity and engulfs everything and everything that you are and do. I mean, at the tail end, we're looking at like the last, 4 to 10 weeks, probably, because you want to delay that from happening is to the best of your capabilities, really. But then afterwards, you give back to your life and the people around you that supported you, and you start to rebuild and repair. And yeah, I mean, that's kind of an odd space too in the fitness world too, because it's pressuring on athletes who feel like they need to look a certain way. Like,
well, that's social media. Social media did that. It was not like that before social media.
No,
before social media, everybody knew that most professional bodybuilders got kind of fat in the off season.
Yeah, and to go a little off topic, but just to tell a little story, like, in the culture that I grew up in, we did have seasons. Whether you were an athlete or not, you had the summer season where you were more comfortable in the summer, and the winter season where you did your growing as an athlete. You got stronger, more muscular in the winter, and then the summertime you sort of enjoyed being a little leaner. And as silly as it sounded and as vain as it was, because it very much so was, when you think about it in more serious terms, it actually did create a way where you could give your body a break for half of the year.
When we look at the top level professional bodybuilders today, now granted, they're on more performance enhancing drugs than anybody else in the world, so we shouldn't look at them the same way we would look at ourselves. But to this day, those bodybuilders, they gain 40, 50, 60, 70 pounds in the off season and then lose it. They don't really care. They are literally basically kings in the bodybuilding world, and their bodies are capable of doing that because of all of the substances that they're taking. Even before, people who were not as famous or weren't even trying to be famous, people would do what Giacomo just said. They would deliberately gain weight in the off season, put on body fat, and then get shredded for summer. But now social media has everybody just on display 24/7, 365, and people feel this insane amount of pressure to have their physiques look a certain way all the time that just isn't realistic. little insider secret is that most people in the fitness arena, there's one of two types of people. One person tries to stay shredded year round and pays often tremendous social and health costs to do that. The other group of people get lean, take a crap load of photos, and post them all year until they're lean again. So you don't ever have to see their fluffier physique online. They're both not great. But I don't even think this is just fitness. Like, obviously that's what we see the most of, but because of social media, there's like a ton of social pressure to be the best dressed and have the nicest house and have the most aesthetic house for taking pictures and film. I mean, how many times have Giacomo and I, we've looked at each other and been like, this is the worst house to film things in. But it's like, we like this house. Yeah. It's just not a good house for taking pictures or filming things in.
And I'm out of the loop here because I know that what I'm saying right now is probably not going to be a shock to many people. To me, it was though, when we were traveling at going to different fit expos and we were renting certain places, they were like touted as being YouTube ready or what have you. Like they were designed in a certain way to be aesthetic. And I feel like it's more than just renting places like that. People model their homes to literally be social media ready, which is crazy to me.
Yes. Crazy. It's like the equivalent of what I assume women in the 70s did with like Better Home and Gardens magazines. Like everybody wanted their house in Better Home and Gardens magazine. Do you remember that?
I do.
Yeah, that seems like something your family would be keenly aware of. But now it's social media and it's everybody. And it's every aspect of your life. Is your dog the cutest dog? Can you get the cutest pictures of your cute dog? Is your house absolutely gorgeous? Is it clean all the time? Are your kids perfectly social media ready? Which is like, that's a whole ass other thing I could talk about, kids on social media and how it gives me the heebie-jeebies. The point of what we're saying here is sometimes in the pursuit of the best self-care, you gotta let some of this stuff go. People are feeling so much pressure to perform in so many ways that we never have before that a lot of people are just constantly drained. And then you add to that, in my opinion, this pandemic, we're gonna see the psychological repercussions of everybody working from home all of a sudden. I'm already seeing it. I don't know if you're seeing it with your clients, but my clients that suddenly had to work from home back in March, it was like so cool, right? Like, oh, I'm working from home and I don't even have to put on pants. Listen, guys, we've been working from home for like 7 years now exclusively, and it's not that glamorous, okay? Suddenly what happens if you're not careful is you're never 100% working and you're never 100% at home. It's this weird blob where you're always at home and you're always working and you're never 100% on and you're never 100% off. And I think a lot of people are just spreading themselves so thin and having no reprieve that more people are turning to these Netflix binges and midnight snacking and all these other retail therapy has been huge this year. Like people just buying things online, whether or not they can afford them, because their life is set up in a way that is not making them happy, that is not keeping them happy. And it requires you to hit pause and ask yourself a lot of big questions. And I think everybody can ask themselves these questions forever. It's not like you're going to figure it out and be like, well, this is my life now and this is how it will be forever because this is what makes me happy. You got to keep tweaking it forever.
In some ways, the pandemic has shined a spotlight on what really matters in our lives and how much we are working towards it or not. And that's cool. And in another sense, while there is time to reflect and work on it, we are somewhat limited to what we can do to change it. I'd love to sit here and tell you that I have all the answers and I know what to do. And the truth is I don't. I think that there is some work there to be done, but we also have to understand that there are some limitations because it's a frustrating path to a better person right now. But that doesn't mean that there aren't some ways that we can get to a better place and use this time to really think about who we are, why we're doing what we're doing, and what we're actually doing with ourselves.
Before we move on to our question and answer segment, we would love it if those of you who listen to this podcast regularly and enjoy it, if you could leave us a review. It really helps us in iTunes, Spotify, Stitcher, wherever you listen to your podcasts. It really helps a podcast to receive reviews so that it can become more visible to other people. So if you are so inclined, go ahead and pause this podcast, leave us a review. And if you send us a screenshot of your review, we will, and if you send us a screenshot of your review, we will email you a copy of our Vegan Proteins holiday cookbook. So we would super appreciate that, guys. And we hope you like the cookbook. Moving on to our question and answer segment. Do you have experience with elbow pain from lifting? It's gradually gotten worse over the last few months. I've been wearing stoic elbow sleeves and they've helped out some, but not enough. I read that weak forearm muscles may contribute to the problem, so I've been working on those. But in the meantime, do you have any advice for relief?
I love this question because I've dealt with elbow pain off and on for years. And most of the time, I feel like it's avoidable, and sometimes it's not. You're at the point where you have tendinopathy, tendinitis, if you will, and I'm not sure what part of the elbow it is. It could be either on the outside part or the inside part, tennis elbow or golfer's elbow, as they call it. Both are caused by your muscle and your bone and your nerve. All three of those are connected, and your nerve is in between your muscle and your bone. And when your muscle is tight, it's pressing down on the nerve into your bone, triggering that inflammatory, painful response. The most immediate thing that I have found works is to find a way to break up the fascia in your muscle tissue on your forearm. I like to use a technique called nerve flossing. You do it with a long latex band. It's called a flossing band. You can get one for like 10 bucks on Amazon. And I'll leave a link in the show notes for one actually. And you wrap it around your elbow relatively tight. And then you start to move your elbow around in different directions. And as the latex band expands and contracts, it is literally giving your muscle a massage, and it's breaking up the muscle tissue that is all knotted up and pressing down on the nerve. It provides a little bit of instant relief. It increases your range of motion, and because you broke up the connective tissue and muscle in that area, it promotes blood flow. When you have more blood flow in an area where there is a nerve impingement and tendinopathy, you're able to better shuttle nutrients into that area, which means that it is more likely to be repairable. The other thing you need to do is stop it from being aggravated. The best ways to do that are to be mindful of how you're working that elbow joint. There are a couple of tips that I recommend as far as training is concerned. When it comes to curls specifically, they tend to overwork the forearm and overwork the elbow joint. And you can use something called BFR training, blood flow restriction training, to be able to still have a good workout without using heavy weight. You can use 20% of your normal working weight by BFR bands. And rather than explaining this, I'll also leave a link in the show notes for BFR training so you can better understand it, because it's a little difficult to explain succinctly. But basically, finding ways to lighten up the load and the pressure on your elbow joint. I find that forearms get overworked when it comes to rows, pulls, and curls. So I try to take forearms out of the exercise or minimize the amount of strain that I put on my forearms. VersaGrips are incredibly useful for targeting the lats on rows and pulls. VersaGrips literally take your forearm out of the exercise when you wear them. They're like wrist straps, but not quite as uncomfortable to wear. And they make it so that your forearm is not doing the work, and your bicep for that matter, and your back is. So on rows and pulls, I highly recommend actually using VersaGrips. You're still gonna get forearm and grip strength from other exercises. And on curls, I recommend being mindful of how often you're doing them. And if you've gotten to the point where you need relief, try BFR training. This question's for Danny. Can you fill me in about fat burners? I've never considered them before. Are they safe? And can you suggest a safe vegan option?
Most of the fat burners that exist that actually work are illegal. And I think that's really important to be aware of. There are actual fat burners that exist, that work, that are considered performance-enhancing drugs. They're illegal. in, they're certainly illegal in the United States and probably a lot of other places too. The top one that comes to my mind is ephedra. So this was, I remember this was legal when I was a kid because my dad used to take it, but then it caused all these heart problems and heart attacks and then it was illegal. So ever since then, that was like the biggest mainstream fat burner, I would say. And when it became illegal, a lot of other like over-the-counter fat burners started coming out. And this is what most people are thinking of when they say fat burners. They're thinking of the stuff that you can buy like in GNC or something like that, which does not have ephedra in them. So what is in them? Usually caffeine, usually a lot of caffeine. The caffeine is a fat burner. It's an appetite suppressant. It speeds up the metabolism and it's relatively safe unless you're taking a lot of it, which unfortunately a lot of the fat burners on the market are pretty high in caffeine. You know, the same thing could be said for pre-workouts. They're, what is the magic ingredient? Most of the time it's caffeine. So pre-workouts, fat burners, very similar in that they're high in caffeine. So coffee is cheaper and probably safer and does have some health benefits. The other fat burners that I would say that are legal and do technically work, but to such a small degree that the question is like, is it worth it? Would be capsicum, which is pepper, cayenne pepper. It makes such a small difference, but I guess technically it makes some kind of a difference, but you don't have to take capsicum. You could also just eat it and put it in your food. And also yohimbine, which is a bark of a tree, I believe. It comes in two different forms. Yohimb is one, and that is like an unregulated dose. It's not standardized. You don't know how much you're getting and it has to be taken under very specific conditions. It affects everybody so differently. There is a standardized version of this called Yohimbine HCL. Yes, technically it does work if you consume it in a fasted state, if you do a specific type of cardio while in that fasted state. But again, it makes a tiny, tiny difference. This is not something that I recommend to most people. It is something that I recommend only to not even all of my competition clients, just a few of my competition clients that can tolerate it. And I say that because it gives a lot of people straight up anxiety attacks. Yes, full-blown anxiety attacks. Like Giacomo, for example. That one time he tried it, full-blown anxiety attack. It doesn't give me an anxiety attack. I actually quite like it at that phase in my prep, but this is not something that you would want to use for just dieting all willy-nilly. You wouldn't want to use this at the beginning of a diet. There's a very specific dosage that somebody should be taking based on their body weight. And I would not recommend this to 95% of people out there. So does it work? Yes, technically a little bit, but the fat burner on the market that works the best is caffeine. And that is what I would recommend people use very strategically in order to aid their diet. Again, none of these work. Absolutely, there is zero fat burner in the entire world that works if you're not in a caloric deficit. You have to be in a caloric deficit, and that does all the heavy lifting for losing body fat anyway. You can also continue to create that caloric deficit with cardio. So what a fat burner does is it can give you a little bit more energy to do a little bit more movement, to do a little bit more cardio, to burn a little bit more calories, along with a tiny thermogenic bump with some of these. But in general, I would avoid all of the over-the-counter fat burners like the plague. It's just a waste of money. All these like green coffee pills. And what are some of the other big ones that are out there? Oh man, I haven't looked in so long. They're mostly garbage. They're mostly hot garbage. Coffee, capsicum, and in very, very, very rare instances, yohimbine HCL in a very specific dose, in a very specific conditions. But almost all of the work is going to be done by a caloric deficit.
Well, I just wanted to add one thing to that. If you do use something like yohimbine, you eventually become adapted to it and you got to give your body a break from it.
Yeah, that's an important point. None of my clients, when they do take it, ever take it for longer than 6 weeks. In my 10-ish years of working with people, I think I've only had maybe between 5 and 7 clients actually use it. So mm-hmm. that's how rarely I recommend it.
All right, everybody, thanks so much for tuning in to another episode of Vegan Proteins Muscles by Brussels Radio. Feel free to stay in touch with us in our Facebook group, Muscles by Brussels, and on Instagram, YouTube, Twitter,
Twitter, Facebook, at Vegan Proteins and at Muscles by Brussels. Drop me an email, veganproteins@gmail.com, with any questions or feedback that you have. We love keeping in touch. Once again, my name is Giacomo.
And I'm Danny.
And we'll talk to you soon.